Welcome to Pod X Medicine, the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. I am your host, Sunny, and today I have the wonderful Evie with me. Evie, how are you?
Hey there, Sunny. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're not on a shift today. I've actually just understood that you're departing the hospital for several months. You're on your own adventure at the moment. What are you doing?
Yeah, that's correct. About to head off for 4 months up to Sydney, up to Holsworthy to do some Army Reserves training, and hopefully finish it all off and commission at the end of it.
Looks like I'll be saluting Evie at the end of this. Today, Evie, we have a really exciting guest today. We have Dr. Kate, and I can never pronounce her last name, so I'm not even going to try because often it sounds way worse. We've got Dr. Kate, clinical psychologist, with us today. She's also all things adventure, high performance. But Dr. Kate, welcome, and thank you for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, listen, I could do an introduction and it would just be horrendous because I wouldn't touch on half of the things that you are actually involved in. Can you just share with us quickly who you are and what you're doing?
Yes. So I am a clinical and performance psychologist. I came into psychology in a slightly different way than most people. And as a result, and also as a result of raging ADHD, I have bounced around a lot in my career and done a kind of a whole range of odd things. So I began my work as a psychologist in the military. So I was in the military for 15 years in a variety of roles, part-time and full-time, from a soldier to a signals officer to a psychologist. And I left to undertake my clinical doctorate, my postgraduate degree. During that time, which, you know, was supposed to take 4 years, but took 6 years as they do, I kind of did any job that anyone would pay me for. So that was not just counselling. That was, keep your mind out of the gutter, by the way, Sonny. I can see where that's going right now. But that was more so things like organisational training, trauma response work, resilience training, working with footy players, sort of anything. And then I worked for the Federal Police for a while. I became the head psychologist at NRL. I deployed to Bangladesh during the Rohingya crisis as part of a first responder medical team. And then I wound my way back to doing what I love, which is working with first responders. So at the moment, my primary work is with Fire and Rescue New South Wales. I run or I facilitate wellness retreats for fireys with psychological injury, mostly PTSD. And we've now been doing that for 4 years, which is great. We run 18 retreats and they're really fun. And also they're in a 5-star resort. So who could hate that? Aside from that, so that's my kind of professional side of things. My passion projects have always been in the outdoors. So I've always been a climber. I'm currently a canyon guide in the Blue Mountains as well. So I laugh and say that Monday to Friday, I heal trauma. And then on the weekends, I induce trauma by throwing people off cliffs and waterfalls and all sorts. Then I give them my card and say, come back and I'll heal you during the week and make my own business model. No, I don't really. But over the course of my career and with my love of the outdoors, I've seen a really big gap in support, mental health and psychological support for people who love the outdoors. So not just, you know, clients per se, but, you know, adventurers, you know, what happens in the mountains? Because as we know, in the outdoors, wild stuff happens. And when wild stuff happens, but there's no support afterwards or no emotional processing, there can be some really big long-term fallout. So over the past few years, one of my passions has been creating a number of programs and initiatives to help develop support systems and understanding and knowledge of human behavior and support for people in remote environments, whether that's climbing guides or whether that's people who witness a potential critical incident or have had a really tough time outside or have a really bad expedition or even just coming home from an expedition and transitioning back and trying to make sense of what, you know, what's happened. So that's sort of my general summary of where I'm at.
Evie, I told you she had done a lot in her career. And I'm going to have to circle back to several things here. But I mean, it's such a kind of eclectic mix. You've been a clinical psychologist and a performance psychologist. You're going to have to educate me on the difference there, but you've worked with everyone from high performance sporting teams. You mentioned the NRL to what sounds like a humanitarian deployments, Bangladesh, things like that, to emergency medicine, working with first responders. And then just to, I guess, mix that together in, even more, you're also a wild climber, explorer, expeditioner. There's so many things here that I need to unpack. But I want to focus in really quickly because you said when wild things happen or wild stuff happens, quite often there's no support. Now, is this something you found between all of these different kind of agencies you worked with, where it be performance, sports teams, humanitarian deployments, first responders, expeditions, when wild things happen, often there's no support. Where is that kind of relating to?
Where it first started, excuse me, I'm just going to have to clear my throat. Excuse me. Where it first started was in around 2010. I was climbing Mont Blanc in Chamonix, and I was a client, so I had a guide, and we climbed, and there's a really dangerous area, a couloir that's notoriously dangerous. And we climbed up on one side of it and you had to cross it. And it's dangerous because there's a lot of rock fall and you have to do it in certain times of the day because the snow melts and the rock falls and all that sort of stuff. We're on one side, but we're just kind of crested a ridge. And over the other side, about 100 meters away, I saw one of those moments that you watch and it takes kind of a moment to work out what you've just seen. But I saw a man fall and fall and fall and fall. And then his body ragdolled. And he just kept going, and everything fell out of his pack, and he died. So our guide at the time, and again, it took me a moment. Our guide at the time, French guide, wonderful guide, terrible with emotions, terrible with human interaction. He called in helicopter rescue, so we watched and waited for that, and they came and picked it up. It was like a claw. It was actually really quite disturbing. They just picked up the body and carried it away. And then we just carried on as if nothing had happened. And I was okay with that because, of my experience, I've seen some weird and wild and wonderful things. But my climbing partner was not. So he completely froze. And then once we started to move again, he was in tears. He was in shock. It was a typical response to seeing something like that. But our guide was like, let's just go up the hill. Let's just keep going. And so we made it to the hut that night. And my climbing partner was just completely distressed, as he should be. And the guide turned to him and said, talk to Kate, she's a psychologist. And I thought that was the worst thing ever, not just because I'd also seen it, and also I wasn't being a psychologist on that trip, I was actually a client and a climber, but because he just had no idea what to do. And I think he had no idea, he literally himself didn't, just it wasn't through a lack of care. It was just through a lack of knowledge of how to deal with humans in distress in that environment. And so that got me thinking that there is such an absence of support, even for him, even for the guide to be able to come down and talk about it with people or just process what happened. And there was nothing from the company. We eventually the my client we actually both went down. He went down a bit earlier, but because of the weather, so we never actually summoned it, which was probably a good thing. But that was the catalyst for me thinking, look, wild things happen, and if something happens, and I know this as a psych, but if something happens and it's unprocessed, then it can lead to really long-term effects on someone's mental health. But also on their joy of being on an expedition or going back out there too. So all of that sort of stuff was bubbling around in my mind for a while, and that's what let everything off. And then I thought, going forwards, during the NRL work and the fire and rescue work, part of my role there have been to set up a network of psychologists who specialize in whether it's, well, it's clinical psychology, so it's, mental health problems, but with a very clear understanding of the context and the environment. So an understanding of what the pressures of NRL are like, an understanding of, some of the stresses, for fire and rescue, an understanding of the culture, the organization, the exposure, how to deal with firefighters. And so that led to what's in the process of being developed, is a network, again, another network of wonderful clinical psychologists who are specialists in critical incidents, emotional processing, potential trauma, but who also have a love of the outdoors and also have an understanding of, emergency services personnel, search and rescue, wilderness paramedics. So the combination, guiding what that might mean and, the vernacular around it. So just so that if anything happens, then we have an avenue that people can go to say, I just need to debrief. I just need to kind of work through what happened. I don't necessarily have PTSD, but, Sunny, we can talk about, well, we're not going to talk about it, but, for example, your near miss with a shark. Having people, a good list of people that you can access who know what they're signing up for,
You've
the
just
clinical
triggered me.
psychologist. Sorry, not sorry. You can come to me afterwards. I think I can debrief you afterwards.
There's that conflict of interest there. She triggers
I'll give
me
you
and then
mates
offers
rates.
support.
Mates rates. But I just thought it just makes sense to do that, like to give access to people who are doing wild and wonderful things. And most of the time, these wild and wonderful things, not all the time, because some of them are just amazing adventures, but in many cases, these people are doing incredible things for the community as well already. So they're putting themselves at risk. So the least we can do is provide some support mechanisms for them if they need it. If they don't need it, excellent. But if they do, or if they do down the track, then they can access it.
I'm genuinely curious, Evie. I've got to defer to you for a second because you've got a lot of experience in hospitals and EDs and things like that. And emergency departments are historically fairly traumatic for anyone who walks through the doors, whether you are a patient or staff or family. And I'm genuinely curious how much, I guess, support is there because from my bias perspective as a paramedic, I've certainly seen the expectation of our profession to deal with the most traumatic thing they've ever seen, and then pack up, mop up, and go respond again 10 minutes later without any support. Is that a similar experience, Evie, or have you guys got more support in your environments?
Yeah, look, it does vary as well, like depending where you are. I've sort of been lucky enough to work in a few different hospitals of varying sizes. And a lot of it can sort of just depend on the team. I think as sort of as you said, Kate, like often once you've seen those things a few times, it doesn't worry you as much and you can just keep going. But I definitely remember some early experiences in my medical career, which, yeah, I was probably like your fellow climber who saw it, didn't really know how to process it, came away just not really knowing who to talk to, what to do. It does get easier for better or for worse, I suppose. But it's definitely, yeah, something I realize. And I think as well, having done a bit of the sort of more army military based resilience type stuff, I do find that it has improved. And Kate, I'm actually quite sort of interested in what you've sort of taken away from your military, but also like sort of all your other experiences as to, building that mental resilience and sort of the factors that you have to have, the external ones and also the internal ones that people build up over time that contributes to how they deal with those processes rather than just you've seen it heaps of times, therefore it's normal, like all the other sort of processes that come with it to build that resilience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there can be a danger in it becoming so normal because, actually what you're seeing and experiencing every day is not normal and should never be normal. And then the fact that it doesn't affect you anymore, it doesn't feel like it affects you, but over time it actually still does. Because what we know with trauma, I don't know if you've heard of Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score. So your body, even if your brain has kind of tucked it away somewhere and it's all normalized, it's still in your body, it's still in your nervous system. So what I found in the research that I've done and the work with on the resilience side of things, the best thing that you can do is, number one, take some time to emotionally process it. We're not taught how to do that, by the way. So no one's taught how to do that. But even just taking the time, taking 10 or 15 minutes that night, the next day, just to actually reflect on what happened and how you feel. and let your brain do what it's going to do, because it's kind of chaos, and work through it. And and part of the reason we don't like to emotionally process, it's because it's uncomfortable, because we actually do feel some emotions, and that's really inconvenient most of the time. So taking a bit of time and not judging yourself if you feel something, also not judging yourself if you don't feel something, but just honoring the fact that something did happen, and just taking a moment to kind of go back over it. Then I think it's listening to your body as well. Your body will tell you things, but it might say, "Hey, I need to go for a run. I've got all these pent-up things inside me. I need to let it out somehow." It might be, "Oh, I want to talk to somebody." It might be, "You know what? I've had a tough day, or lots has happened. What makes me feel better is baking. So go and do some baking." Like, just what we call, normal coping mechanisms. Well, what psychologists call coping mechanisms are what every normal person calls hobbies and interests and things that make you feel good. So making sure that you engage in those after an event, because they're the first things that go when someone's distressed. So you kind of think that, oh, the fact that I love to go climbing, but I've had a really terrible week and I've got all these other things on, so I just won't do that. Whereas actually that's the very thing you need to do in order to feel better. So really recognizing that those things aren't indulgences. They're not nice to have. They're very fundamental in keeping you sane and in keeping you kind of going forwards. There's a whole lot of research in around, what makes up resilience, and it's multifactorial. So it's not just one thing. It's definitely not just pushing through. That used to be what people considered resilience. Now it's actually, it's a combination of diet, sleep, exercise, really simple things. It's having good social support. That doesn't mean having a large social network, but it means having at least one person that you can be your true ugly with. So you can let down your guard, it can all come out, you can be a snot monster and cry. You just don't have to pretend. You can just be with them and talk, or just be with them and not talk. And in fact, even with a dog, right? Even with an animal, just be having a best mate that's an animal who's not never going to give you the wrong answer, because they're never going to talk to you, is perfect. And so it's sort of, there's mind body, mind body, and I suppose spirit in some way, spirit or soul or whatever you want to call it. And that doesn't have to be religion, but that could be being out in nature, going surfing. It could be those sort of things. So it's a combination of all of those, and having a job that you love, or not necessarily that you love, but that you don't hate. So having some meaning and purpose in your life also doesn't necessarily have to be a job. It could be providing for the family, or all those sort of things. So those will ebb and flow throughout. There'll be more emphasis on career at some stage in your life, and then there'll be more emphasis on family at some stage in your life, and there'll be more emphasis on exercise at other stages. But so long as there's a bit of all of those, that's scientifically or empirically what's shown to create the highest levels of resilience. And it is also about honoring the emotions. So it's not about being the tough one that doesn't feel things. It's about feeling them, processing them, and then moving on.
Hey, can I put you on the spot?
Yes.
I want to circle back and let's use your Mont Blanc experience as the case study for where I'm going with this because I appreciate everything you're saying and I reflect on a lot of my own experiences and I think there's actually a lot of little golden opportunities that you've given people to really review how they respond. But a lot of that is when you've got the luxury of time. It's post incident. And what I want to circle back to and just kind of pigeonhole us into is the acute incident, the now, the moment when no one knows really how to react. You've got a guide trying to lead someone who's suffering up a mountain, deferring to it, oh, lucky she's a psych, talk to her. People of. I've had a lot of really interesting experiences through army, through emergency paramedicine, through expeditions, through humanitarian, and it's always intrigued me how people respond in the instant. I actually remember being in a helicopter years and years ago on a deployment, when it obviously got painted by something on the ground, because we started dropping out of the sky, dropping flares and chafe and everything to try and avoid whatever had just been fired at us. And I get goosebumps, right? So you can call that PTSD or PTG, I don't care. But I remember things slowing down for me, because I remember thinking there's nothing I can do except for sit in this seat and hope. And they say hope isn't a strategy, but I mean, the amount of times in my career that I've hoped things work out, this is one of those. But I remember looking around that aircraft as it was kind of falling out of the sky. And I won't name them, but I could see several of my colleagues from my patrol. And one of them, he looked like he was riding a bull at a rodeo. He was so happy and he was so excited that he was obviously in his happy place. There was another one who looked like he was saying a Hail Mary and his final prayer. And then there was another one who just genuinely looked bored because he couldn't do anything. And I always wonder what I looked like in that moment as well, because your amygdala basically explodes through your head. It floods your cerebral cortex with chemicals that are supposed to assist or not. And it's that moment that I feel most people are very ill-equipped to actually deal with. And so when this person you saw fall down the mountain, backpack explode, ragdoll to his unfortunate death happened, I'm going to make an assumption that most people, whether you're a trained mountain guide, whether you are a doctor, whether you are whoever you are, I just don't think most people are actually equipped to deal with things appropriately in that instance. And you can call me wrong, both of you can call me wrong, but I want to pigeonhole us into that moment, because I feel like that is probably, we talk about a lack of support post incidents, but I don't think we talk about enough training to equip ourselves for that moment. And I don't know what moment you can call that. I mean, can we call it I try not to swear, let's call it the holy ship moment. That ship, like a boat, toot toot. Evie and the ED would have had several holy ship moments through one shift. And it's always the luxury of time, the minutes after that, bring us back. We got algorithms to follow. I mean, you've even got whiteboards and trauma teams to lean on, out on the street, paramedics don't even have that, but they're supposed to navigate and move through. So without the luxury of time and the kind of the longevity of this is what we should do, that moment, how can we equip ourselves better for that?
So, very good question. Lots to unpack there.
I told you I'd put you on the spot. I'm sorry.
No. It's genuinely a really good question. And different roles will be different things. And through experience, you'll do it in a different way as well. I can say that as even for me, well, but for you guys as well, because of your experiences, you'll have become experts at compartmentalization. So, in the moment. But then afterwards, you do need to unpack it. But because you've been through so many things, you know yourself, you know what needs to be done, you're task focused, you're task oriented, and so you get through. The impact comes after. But if people don't have that experience yet, or if they're very junior, the best thing that they can do in that moment is to slow down. Slow down and breathe, because like you said, the amygdala is doing all sorts of chaos and everything fires up, everything gets faster, thoughts get faster, heart gets faster, the faster your thoughts, the faster your heart, the faster your thoughts. If you slow down, you can actually make good decisions throughout that moment.
How do you slow
There's
down?
drugs and alcohol mostly.
Potato,
No,
potato, safe
honestly,
word.
if I'm honest, how do I slow down? I don't, like, honestly, I think just over time, I've just learned to stay still and not jump into the fray, just take a moment, breathe, and then 2 seconds or take one deep breath can actually just set you up for what you're
One deep
about to do.
breath.
Yep, one deep breath, one slow deep breath.
So if I brought a dying patient into the ED and Evie sat there and took one deep breath, I'd look at her like she's a clown.
Maybe for
I
1 second, one deep second,
shouldn't
and then she's
dismiss it.
going to perform better. The other thing is, in terms of training, so we talked about kind of post-pension, after the fact processing, awesome. But if you can access some really high fidelity training, and organizations don't often do that, like government organizations, so New South Wales Health isn't going to put you through high fidelity training. But your own professional development, if you can attend courses through the academy, through TACMED, through all the sorts of places that put you in unconventional situations, put you under pressure, then you learn how you naturally respond. You learn you're ugly. You learn what your kind of, when the shit's hitting the fan, what your innate response is. And that might be panic, it might be fear, it might be tears, it might be anything. And then once you know yourself, you can then start to practice good behaviors under stress, if that makes sense. So it's kind of, you almost have to be in realistic but safe simulated environments to build up your capability to perform well under stress.
Are we
Not just to cope,
moving?
but to perform well.
Are we moving into things like stress inoculation then?
Yes, and performance psychology. So it's the same kind of thing, putting you under pressure and simulated pressure, stress inoculation. And it's not, some of the best stress inoculation doesn't have to be physically dangerous. So there's a really great example. It's a bit of a nerdy example. It's called the Sing Song Test. You're basically in a room of people, and someone's out in front of you, like, hey, okay, cool. So I want you to take a moment and write down your favorite song. And everyone writes it down. And then you ask a few people, and you're like, cool, okay, what was yours? What was yours? And then say, right, I'm going to ask one of you to stand up in front of the room and sing your favorite song. So you can imagine everyone's like, not gonna be me, and I'm gonna be terrible. And you can actually see their stress response go up. And then no one wants to make eye contact, because if you make eye contact, then you're gonna be chosen and
My
all that
stress
sort of stuff.
response would go up.
Exactly. And so you leave them feeling that stress for a very prolonged pregnant pause as the stress builds, and then you say, no, we're not gonna do that. And then you talk about the physiological stress response and go, how did you feel? What was that like in your body? What was that like in your brain? So you don't actually have to be in dangerous situations to kind of induce that stress response, but you can do it in a really fun way. But it all comes back to kind of understanding yourself. And if you understand yourself, then you can start to kind of plan and prepare and build on what is your natural stress response.
I love it. Evie, have you got, how do you downregulate? Like what's one of your methods that you use in your current role?
I actually very much attest to the deep breathing, and I can't remember who it was who sort of got me onto it, because classic med student type, very stressy, and I did find early on that when those patients come in that are just a bit of a mess, you just don't know where to start, I would always panic. But some brilliant person put me on to well, I was told take three deep breaths, but either one, pick an odd number. And that's what I do now. And I actually find it does really help. And I've used it for, everything, just like med stuff, like army stuff. And you can feel the difference. Like after those three breaths, your brain just has that split second to process, and you're good to go. So I very much back that.
And that's a down regulation technique. I mean, both you're talking about breathing. I mean, it's got to, I guess, be similar to box breathing and things like that. Hey, the four in, four hold, four exhale, four hold. It's interesting because I remember some of the guys that I served with are laughing at the because and we were given some down regulation techniques, and this is how you get yourself back on track. And the notion of stacking up on a door that's got some hostile people on the other side, you're about to breach it. Things like box breathing or breathing deeply, it doesn't. Again, the luxury of time, I guess. But I mean, there's little things too. Like, I think it was called a tactical pause. I need to review some things, but it was three quick breaths in through your nose and one long exhale, was supposed to have a similar effect. But it's interesting, even if we relate this, I guess, back to the climbing incident, with the guide. I mean, like I said, most people are fairly ill-equipped. I mean, you could go on 100 expeditions and not actually suffer a major trauma like that, watching a death. I mean, I lose count of the amount of times I tell people that so much of the work we do in remote and extreme environments is actually primary care and mental health, because there's so many different layers of risk assessments. But at the end of the day, it is a very uncontrolled environment that we're working in. Anything can happen. But I'm not convinced either that, I guess, the having the ability to downregulate would have assisted that guide, and I've only got, fragments of information of that case. So I guess it circles back to, I guess, the stress inoculation and the training. How do we get people in a better place? I think so many medics are extremely, clinically proficient, and so many guides are extremely technically proficient. And then you've got a mix in between too, where you've got clinicians who are also technical, guides. There seems to be, though, a real lack of training in the, would I call it the mental health space, or would I call it the, I mean, this is a
It's the
very
human
acute.
behavior and understanding space. I completely agree with you. There's very little training. That's another passion project of mine is trying to, and we're starting to do it. In fact, the guiding company that I work with and a couple of others up here are starting to implement some psychological first aid training. And the majority of that, yes, that's all this kind of what to do after a critical incident. But the majority of that is also just how to interact with a human. Because you're right, like a lot of guides, a lot of wild environments, they do it. They become a guide or they become a technical expert because they're passionate about that activity. But you also have to be, as a guide, you also have to be kind of passionate about humans as well, because you can't, your job is not just leading someone somewhere beautiful. It's managing human emotion. And there is an absolute lack of training in that. So I'm working with a couple of people, a couple of companies up here to try and get some basically human behavior training integrated into the Cert for Outdoor and Leadership course for guides. Because again, you get a lot of young, really enthusiastic, want to be guides, but have zero life experience and zero capability to understand emotions. And emotions are kind of the biggest thing when you're in remote environments and uncontrolled territories and in an emergency department. It's all about how you respond to your patients, clients, their families. In many ways, that can be, I'm not saying it is because it definitely isn't, but that can be as important as the technical skill.
I would almost say it is on par. It is a huge, I mean, the course you referenced there, I mean, I completed that 20 years ago when I was a lot younger, and I would agree there was absolutely zero emphasis on any of that. And even, when I look at my clinical training through paramed, again, there's such limited opportunity to actually explore how human behavior responds in extreme environments. And yet that's where we're all working, we're all playing, we're all exploring, and yet it seems like it's a very ill-prepared area for people. It's interesting too, because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, being the resident clinical and performance psychologist, you spoke about resilience before too, and when I observe so many of the different environments I've worked in, the different teams I've worked in, resilience seems to fade in people when they were disempowered or they felt ill-equipped to respond, because then they don't feel worthy. And so even just by creating that little bit more strength in this area, I just feel like we would build the resilience side of things just that little bit more too, if we create more capable people. I mean, sometimes there's nothing you can do, but knowing how to respond in that situation, I think, is probably key. And I mean, Evie, I'm sure you've seen that, across the EDs you've worked in.
Definitely. And I think, Kate, going back to something that sort of you said, I sort of look at some of my colleagues and definitely see the difference, even say between sort of undergrad students and postgrad students. Like, there are unfortunately many doctors who I think probably lack a lot of that understanding of human behavior, which I found, especially in ED, is, I don't know, to be honest, I'd say it's almost more important than the clinical skills for so many patients.
Interesting.
But the doctors, paramedics, the nurses who really understand that are often the ones that have done outdoorsy things, just like have other things in their life, which I think they and again, coming back to resilience, all about those different factors that they draw experience from and have had challenges in that really just help them understand how the world works, how people work, which I think does make an awfully big difference to to patients, to anyone on a team. And yeah, I do find the whole resilience thing very, very interesting and very complex. And I don't know if you sort of have, insight into, for those people in paramedicine, in medicine, to how they get from being a good clinician to being a great clinician by understanding those things, what the steps sort of are.
I think of it as being a good technician versus being a good clinician, because they're the very, very different things. Look, at the risk of referencing, it's not a controversial book, but there is an amazing book that there's a lot of good work in and around, and it's empirically validated. It's called The Resilient Shield, and it's written by three former SAS officers. And it's not, it's very practical, and it's very good storytelling as well. So, and they've all been through, as you can imagine. One was a doctor at the SAS. The other two, one was the commanding officer, one was the officer commanding. And they're very vulnerable in it. And part of the reason it's quite accessible, particularly for first responders, whether it's ED doctors or whether it's paramedics or whether it's military, is because goes into the complexity of the environments. And throughout the book, they're all quite humble because they talk about their experiences and their fuck ups along the way and what they've learned. And then, then there's science and blah, 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 blah. The only thing about the book I don't like is they reference the BMI, which we all know is horseshit, when talking about physical health. But in general, it's a very relatable book and they're not standing on a pedestal preaching. They're actually just really good at storytelling and humor throughout it. And so I think that's probably the most accessible way to then stop and think, okay, this is where am I at? Because you can also, they've got like a survey you can do that pumps out a score, a couple of scores, which shows what aspects of your current life are strongest and what aspects you could improve upon as well. And that's just in terms of, like we said, you might be really high scoring on your career, but really low scoring on social support. So it's more food for thought about where you're at and what you might want to consider to enhance that. And that can then lead on to just implementation of other, mechanisms and things prior to then doing some high fidelity training. So that's kind of just the foundation. Get understand yourself and where you're at. Here are some ideas of things you can include, but also some stress inoculation.
The interesting thing is, I mean, what you're kind of talking to there is culture. And when I talk about culture, I'm not just talking about work culture, team culture. I'm also talking about personal culture because you referenced that there's a vulnerability and a, oh, what was the other word? I should have written it down. But, you know, the question, Evie, around, you know, what makes a good clinician? How to become a good clinician? I think that's a really important question across the spectrum of, you know, medicine entirely, not just extreme environments. But through my own experiences, certainly, you know, through my service, I had some really humble commanding officers, which, you know, I was blessed for. There were some that, you know, they're just turkeys. There were others that just they had that humility that made you want to. Essentially, be them, replicate their behavior. And I took some of those lessons into paramed and then I took those into academia because when I moved into academia, I moved into probably one of the most egotistical places I had ever worked. You know, and that's even talking about 7 years in the Defence Force. Everyone was competing, everyone's trying to one up each other, everyone's trying to be the big dog. And if you are teaching, you are supposed to know everything like God. And it was a really challenging place for me to work in because I didn't know everything. And I certainly had to continue learning to continue teaching because there were developments happening in the clinical space that we hadn't even practiced and we needed to teach. And so the more vulnerable I made myself in front of those students, the more respect I actually gained from them because I humanized the experience. I didn't need to sit on a pedestal at a lectern and tell them how amazing I was. We were just working together, and I've taken that lesson across, numerous expeditions and numerous humanitarian deployments. If I'm leading a team and I'm lost, the first thing I will do is say, "Fuck. Hey guys, bring it in. We're lost. Does anyone know where we are?" Because then it's a group average. And I'm also sharing some of that responsibility. But it is such a better strategy than continuing and not seeking assistance. And, some of the best clinicians I've worked with, some of the best technical specialists I've worked with are actually the most humble and vulnerable people who don't pretend that they know. And I think, it's an added layer of complexity because, I've even said to Kate, "I'm going to put you on the spot and I want to know what to do in this situation," because 20 years later, I'm still trying to figure it out. And the irony is, I don't think anyone will actually know how to respond in that one situation because, firstly, every situation is going to be different. And everyone is going to be physiologically and psychologically responding differently anyway. And so I think, bringing the humility in, making yourself vulnerable, not to a point of, incompetence,
Hopelessness, yes.
but to a professional level, in tandem with, some stress inoculation experiences that you can reflect on too, so you can try and prepare, might just be, I guess, what some of us are searching for in this space. But I mean, we could talk all day. I mean, you're a psychologist. You're probably used to people talking your ear off. This is your fault because you triggered me earlier by referencing that shark incident, right? Evie, if
No,
you're
just
not
no.
aware, I was actually working just a very basic water safety shift, must be nearly 2 years ago, when I felt my left foot get bumped to the right. And before I knew what had happened, I was ripped underwater, by more pressure than I've ever experienced in my life. See, I got goosebumps. Thanks, Kate. Incredibly, I knew instantly what it was, and I actually accepted my fate fairly quickly. Holy shit, this is a shark. A shark has got my leg. I'm dead. I'm going to make this bitch pay. Right. And so in me was a pretty useless fight. I'm pretty sure I was squealing underwater. And then the irony is, I actually felt it bite my foot off, pop, right? And that let me surface. So now I thought I was bleeding everywhere. And I started swimming like an absolute clown towards one of the rescue skis that had seen the commotion that was coming towards me. And while I was swimming to that ski, it confirmed my foot was missing. I could feel my foot missing. And it wasn't until Jeff, he's my hero, lifted me up onto the ski that I knew I was going to survive, but I was convinced I was still bleeding. And we realized I still had a booty on, which made me just erupt into drunken laughter. Because what we realized is that when the shark had grabbed my foot, it had grabbed my fin, the flipper. I had a massive pressure injury up the foot from when its jaws clenched down. But it had grabbed my fin and ripped me underwater. And the popping sensation I felt was actually the strap snapping. It wasn't my foot coming off. But me swimming towards the ski with one fin on made me feel lopsided, made me confirm what I thought I knew. The reason I'm sharing this story with you is because it was one of the most traumatic incidents I had suffered in a long time. And thankfully, when I was hauled back up onto the crew barge next to the picture boat, the entire production had stopped. I was shaking like a leaf. I couldn't control that. I was sat to one side for a moment before the dive supervisor Shay, he's one of my favorite people, said to me, "All right, we're going to get you to shore." And I said to him, No, I'm good. I'm not hurt. Get me back in it. You fall off a bike, you got to ride it." And he grabbed me and he said, "You're not in a position to be making these decisions." And he literally put me on the boat. And I'm still grateful to this day that he did because I wasn't in any psychological capacity to make any decisions. But why I'm sharing this with you is because when I got home, I was still shaking and I'd been processing a lot on that drive. My kids nearly lost me. My wife nearly lost me. Maybe I need to rethink my career. My God, I woke up this morning. I nearly died like so many people I've seen. But as I went in the door, I couldn't even tell my wife what happened because she was in a flat because our second oldest child, a daughter, she's been suffering significant health problems her entire life, including battling a rare cancer. She had become quite sick that day, and Shelley had actually been trying to ring me to say, "I need you to come home. We're going to hospital." And so I had gone from one of the worst traumas of my life, and I just need to debrief and talk to my wife about what had happened to, oh wow, this just escalated. I need to bury this incident because something worse is happening. My daughter is now deathly sick and going to hospital again. And it was actually 3 days later we got her home that I could sit there while we're eating Weet-Bix for dinner, just to spell out how, terrible everything had gone. That I could say, hey, listen, the last 3 days have been fairly sleep deprivingly traumatic. Sky's still a bit sick, but we've still got her. You also need to know a shark nearly killed me 3 days ago. And I remember Shelley just kind of stopped, mid-spoon, and she kind of looked up at me and just kind of went, okay, we'll deal with that shortly, And it was just another whole layer of complexity in the resilience, I guess, subject that I thought that I understood, because I had never had to bury something that had been so traumatic so quickly to then focus on something that had become worse.
Leading on from that, I suppose, and given your work, like with the, like retreats for the fireys and how you help people recover from those, very traumatic events or just that sort of trauma fatigue, what is it you sort of focus on?
So very practical for things. One thing with first responders is that they are typically fixers, problem solvers. And when, with the fatigue, with the stress, with the traumatic stress, one of the things that is also even more terrifying or compounds how terrified they are is the fact that they have to relinquish agency over their own health and well-being to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And so even that lack of agency compounds how they're feeling. But it's all physical stuff and it's all down regulatory stuff. So we start the week with surfing. We work with Waves of Wellness. So it's kind of a get to know you and a surfing lesson. So they're out and about. There's no more than 10 firefighters at each retreat. And then we have one group introductory session, and that's awful for everybody, but also one of the most powerful parts. So we all sit in a circle and then everyone just talks a little bit. We talk about, how the retreat's gonna, what to expect and blah, blah, blah. But everyone shares a little bit about themselves. And we say, look, as little or as much as you want, you could literally just say, hi, I'm Kate. I'm here because my cup is full. Or, they could tell a bit more about if they've been off work for a while. We dissuade them from talking about specific incidents because we don't want to compound any one story to compound, another person's trauma, but just about that. And what we often get with that, the feedback is that, they're almost hearing themselves in each other's stories. And having that makes them feel less isolated and that they're not alone and that they're not losing their mind and, all that sort of stuff. So it can be a really powerful, albeit exhausting session. One guy that was really great, he said, fucking hated breath work. It was bullshit. And then he goes, but I realized that it was actually really good for me and I felt good afterwards. So what I'm going to do is instead of doing 20 minutes of bullshit, when I put the kettle on in the morning, I'm going to do breath work for the time it takes that I press the kettle till I pour my coffee. So kind of keeping it just, that's amazing. Because if you do that, that's achievable and realistic and sets you up for if you want to do more or if you don't. Or it might be, someone was like, oh, again, the breath work side of things. But I live on acreage, so I can do breath work when I take the bins out, because I have to walk 500 meters, so I'll do it then. But the reason we've focused on the physiological side of things is it re-empowers them to do things for themselves. And it's practical. And, fireys like practical stuff. And scientifically, all the things that they're doing are fantastic for them. And they can keep doing them as well to the level that they want to, and make it real for them.
It sounds like the real takeaway for, as with Sunny's story or anyone who has those very sort of acute traumatic episodes or just anything like that is really just that down regulation, just having a chat to people, taking time for yourself.
And that's exactly it, taking time for themselves. And that for first responders, for medical personnel, is something that, with lots of love and respect, you all suck at. So, putting yourself
True.
first for a change instead of putting everybody else first is something that's really important, but you all suck at it. So it's kind of a good
Accurate.
reminder, a good reminder to actually do that.
Interestingly, Kate, too, I mean, I've heard people say sometimes that you need to understand when you are the clinician and when you are the patient. And there is a thin professional boundary that you shouldn't cross. And it's when you're personally involved in things, you're the patient. But I find that boundary doesn't apply when you're working in rural, remote, or extreme environments, because often those communities are small enough that regardless of what happens, you will know the person who it involves personally. It'll either be you or it'll be someone you know. And so you're actually expected to operate as a clinician in a very personal situation. And, I find some of the biases sometimes from just, clinical medicine, don't really apply to the environments that so many of us are working in. And I think having the ability to understand those and the boundaries, but also understanding where those boundaries don't apply, is again only going to increase, your resilience or your ability or your capability to actually respond appropriately in the moment, and then also post that moment. Your retreats sound like they're hell though. All I heard's ice baths and singing a favorite song. I'm not going.
But ironically, while we're doing this for the people with psychological injury, it leads straight into the performance psychology side of things. So it's exactly the same kind of mechanisms of action and exactly the same treatment. It's just it's sexied up for performance psychology. So you'll see elite athletes doing breath work, elite athletes doing ice baths, elite athletes doing psychological, reframing and all sorts of things. And that's really great, but it's exactly the same as treatment as we do for people with PTSD, just different words. It's like the whole, if you're speaking to a soldier and you're teaching them about breathing, you have to frame it in a way, you can talk about tactical breathing or a tactical pause. Whereas if you talk about woo-woo hippie meditative breathing, you've lost them entirely. So, same as firefighters, we talk about in terms of teaching them breathing, we always reference, elite athletes and special forces and blah, 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 and also bring it back to when they're in their BA, their breathing apparatus. So you have to kind of sell it differently, but it's exactly the same as if it was, therapy, basically.
Just adjusting your communication technique.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I was going to ask what's next, but I mean, excitingly, I've been privy to some of the conversations through the academy. We're going to start looking at how to better support clinicians and workers in extreme environments, both from a response perspective and a mental health perspective. I've heard that you're going to head up that committee, which is going to be interesting and fun. But what's next for you personally?
At this stage, at the moment, I'm in a really happy place, balancing my psych work and canyon guided because that's really nice. And I live in a beautiful place, and being able to head up the advisory group, that side of things, and continue to engage in the wilderness outdoor side of things is just makes me very, very happy. So, adventures, my partner and I are talking about cycling across New Zealand. Sooner rather than later. That said, I don't even have a bike, so that's typically my style, jump into something I don't know what I'm in for. But aside from that, just kind of keep going with what's happening, really.
Awesome. Evie, when are you off to the army?
I'm off not next week after.
And how
So
long
soon.
until I've got to salute you?
You got till the beginning of July.
I've got both of you in front of me. I've got to salute both of you. I was going to be
Two
promoted
hands. You
once.
can salute with two hands, right? One for each of us.
Look, Kate, Evie, thank you so much for being here today. I have thoroughly enjoyed this. I think there's so much we can unpack, and I mean, there's so much we can again. Kate, I think Evie and I are going to get you on again because there's so many things that we didn't even have the time to touch on. But if anyone wants to get in touch with Dr. Kate, please reach out to the Academy. If anyone wants to chat to Evie, Dr. Evie Wilkins, again, reach out to the Academy. We can put you in touch. If you've liked what you've heard, please share it. If you want to look at more of what the Academy is up to, please jump on the website, academyxmedicine.com.au. But until next time, this is Pod X Medicine. Thank you.